CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. The SAP Business by Design solution is a single integrated business management solution that delivers the best of SAP software on demand, offering the benefits of larger applications without the need for a costly IT infrastructure. And Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News, Accounting Today stated, cash flow and not the economy is the top concern for chief financial officers heading into 2011, according to a survey from TD Bank. Some 69% of CFOs and other corporate finance managers at mid-sized businesses said the challenge of managing cash flow worries them more than most. 41% of those polled project that cash flow management will remain one of 2011's top management priorities. However, despite the cash concerns, only 7% of corporate finance managers say that they plan to slash expenses in 2011, while 39% of those surveyed expect their capital investments to increase next year. Roughly 78% of those surveys noted that the economic recovery might take up to 2 years to materialize, and 46% opined that one of the surest signs of a lasting upturn will be the falling unemployment rates. The TD Bank survey was conducted by Environix Research, which surveyed 100 CFOs, controllers, treasurers, and other financial executives. Well, today, Michael Moran joins us to discuss the role of the CFO in the finance function. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, Mike, you're the corporate controller of Currie & Company, a leading wholesale manufacturer of home furnishings and lighting. You oversee the company's accounting, reporting, and budgeting, and also the information technology, human resources, and then company compliance. Previously, you were the CFO of IsraVision, the CFO and vice president of finance for Coloplast, the corporate controller for Gravo Graf, and the controller for PerkinElmer. Your career has spanned large publicly held companies down to small privately held companies. You're a CPA and have an MBA in finance from the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School, and you have a Bachelor in Economics from Arkansas at Fayetteville. Well, Mike, we're thrilled to have you on the show. Let's talk a little bit about your early part of your career. Your current role, obviously, you oversee accounting and finance for the Currie & Company. But what about your first position? What was that and what led that to where you are today?
Well, in some ways, actually, where I am today was started at the dinner table back home. My father was a small town banker. And we discuss business all the time. He'd come, a small town, you can't hide anything. You know all the gory details of all the business successes and failures in town. And by almost osmosis over time, I became interested in that. And that's ended up why I actually went to the Wharton School and in business. And I started off in a Fortune 500 environment. And it becomes increasingly over time, as everybody knows because of SOX, that it became more compliance-driven public company environment. And I really wanted to get more involved in the business side, which is a small company, lends itself more to you getting more in the business side environment. In fact, even when I was on the Fortune 500 company, I used to volunteer for roles in more entrepreneurial startups within the Fortune 500 company.
When they were making acquisitions and such?
Yeah, acquisitions, startups. We had a lot of high-tech engineers and geeks that had great ideas, and they would finance them, and I became their corporate mentor about how to get through all the maze of corporate regulations and rules.
So what did you like about that? Who was that first role, and what did you like about it?
Well, I was, as far as, like, we helped do X-ray inspection equipment that is now been rolled out in the airports. There was some really high-tech. There was an astronaut from NASA that was in the space lab that was trying to take a certain type of process and make it commercial. We had a lot of things like that inspection for food, like to find bones in boneless chicken.
What you mean, how to define what a bone is?
Right. What is a bone? That was driven a lot by, as you can imagine, litigation, McDonald's was a big driver of that kind of technology.
Interesting. So that's very much into the operations, the reality of what it is, the product that you're selling. So was there a specific career move along the years that you would say was a very significant move for you?
Well, when you're a Fortune 500, you've got a nice corporate cozy environment. And I like to call myself a Fortune 500 refugee because I went from that corporate environment with all the structure and support network and also disciplines in place to smaller companies in which the support network's there. And you've got to develop your own support network outside the company. And that's quite a shock when you first do it.
You tend to find that people that are with large corporations almost, well, maybe not quite so much today, but they almost feel as if they're shielded from the unemployment risk and don't really need to network and don't really need to have collaborative peer relationships outside.
Well, also, if there's a tax problem, they call it the corporate tax department. They don't really understand it themselves. Mm. Or treasury or banking, and all of a sudden, a smaller company, you are the treasury department.
You've got 10 hats for the day.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, today we're talking a little bit about changeability in the finance function, and also that would impact the top job of the CFO. Today's job expectancy for the CFO is rated to be somewhere as short along the lines of maybe 18 months to 24 months have been some of the stats that have been put out. Downsizing and M&A activities can drive some of this, as among other strategic initiatives. So what we're going to talk with you today is focused around all the different types of transitions. There are corporate transitions, there are personnel transitions, and obviously in order to run a business, they're going to be process, procedure, and all that good stuff. Talk with you, if you would, in terms of the biggest impact of you moving from a publicly held company to that smaller private company. Was there a particular shock? Was there any particular aspect that was new to you?
Well, I would say the surprises were mainly of the good kind because decisions are made fast or tend to be made faster in a private company environment. The owner's there. It's his money. He doesn't need a long, 12-page document that's approved by six layers of corporate bureaucracy. He can say, let's do it. I think this is the right thing to do. Also, corporate politics are reduced because it's his money. You don't have to, there's no hidden agendas where somebody's bonus or wants the next ladder on, go up the ladder of the corporate. And on the interesting side was we'd think money would be the big constraint for small companies. But actually, it's more management time because you don't have the staff and there's no bench. So if the bench is consultants and other advisors you bring in. So that's probably the one of the major constraints that small businesses face that was a little surprising. And of course, as I said before, you have no corporate structure. You have to rely on your contacts with outside vendors, consultants. And it's a challenge at first, but I found it fascinating. After a while, you get some more freedom, you have more input, and it's definitely a lot more learning environment. You're not worrying about SOX. You're not worrying about the various Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and all these items, which I really don't want to read any more FASBs.
No, we hear that so much from the private company CFOs and controllers that we have on the show. So this for you was a very pleasurable move. Obviously, you had some very good training from your background of your education and from the big Fortune 500, which was a heavy technology company. So now you're in that new situation. On CFO Radio, we tend to focus on guests that come from a broad range of different industries and different sizes of companies. Did you find the role actually of leading the finance function itself to be any different when you transferred from, you were firstly with scientific equipment and medical devices and then went to machinery, and now today you're in a consumer goods environment? What were the key differences in terms of the different industries you had, and what did you, how did you adapt to these?
It does take some work to be able to change industries. Unfortunately, many accountants have kind of a gunfighter reputation. There used to be a Western called half gun will travel, half spreadsheet will travel. But running numbers is very different from running a business. You have different business drivers. And when I start with a new business, I try to get every opportunity I can to get involved in the business. And if you don't do that, you're just treated by everybody else within the business as a number cruncher. So that's probably the key thing, to get involved in the business and to identify the key business drivers and to learn everything you can about what's behind those key business drivers, and to orient your numbers that you generate in accounting to support decisions around those key business drivers.
Are there any particular key business drivers that you've seen over the four or five entities that you've been with?
I think new customers is a key business driver, new products, percent of sales. And it's always surprising how few metrics people often try to run businesses on. But new customers, percent of sales, new businesses, percent of sales, are two key ones that I've always found out to be true, no matter what the industry you're in.
Now, when you're doing that, you mentioned spreadsheets, and very much the world is driven and run by systems and your capability to define and get the detail. Is there anything particular in terms of those spreadsheets and the spreadsheet analysis that you found was a difference between the large corporate 500 versus the privately held?
Well, often in the corporate 500, you had the spread. I mean, they gave you the spreadsheet. This is what thou shalt use. And when you're a smaller company, you're on your own. You can do within imagination pretty much anything you want to, which is, again, a good thing if you like the challenge, and it's tough if you're not used to building spreadsheets.
Does that mean that you're often reinventing from a blank spreadsheet?
It, all the time, yes. And I'm probably a little bit more cognizant of the various weaknesses, because one of the first things I did in analysis one time with the public company was I found there was a spreadsheet error, a $4 million spreadsheet error, and which caused all kinds of consternations and within the company. So I'm very aware that spreadsheets are only as good as you make them, and they can give you junk numbers.
Yeah, and human intervention and spreadsheets can get very complicated with a lot of data. They can be databases that then live a life that feed into the financials, and SOX has a whole level of conversation about that. Well, that being said, what were the differences in terms of expectations of the CEOs? You may not have reported directly to the CEO in that Fortune 500, but obviously that communication filters down. The CEO at that Fortune 500 versus the smaller private companies, what's the focus in terms of financial reporting, maybe accounting operations or strategic finance functions? How are they perceived?
Well, particularly in public companies, as I mentioned a little bit before, it's really a lot involved around corporate governance. Check the box, if you will.
And is that people's mentality? Is the mentality more about, I've got to do this, check the box, rubber stamp it, and push it on?
Yeah. The reporting, because you have a high exposure to the public, a high exposure to government regulations. I was in a meeting where the president of the company told us, your job is to keep me off the Today Show. So there was a real emphasis on that. And I spent, on a tax case one time, I spent like 2,000 hours. I had us record it because it was so extensive. I very rarely had an opportunity to get involved in the business because you're so busy complying with the regulations, because when you're a big company, you are really exposed to IRS, Department of Labor. Everybody wants their two pieces of your organization. Where private companies, you often spend most of the time interpreting the numbers and looking for opportunities to contribute to business decisions, not so much just trying to do the compliance. Compliance is there, you have to work on it, but it's definitely not the main focus of your work. In fact, it's always fun dealing with the owners and founders because they're passionate about the business. They want to understand it. They're not just deal makers. Where it's not so much when you get to bigger organizations.
So their focus is perhaps more strategic and operational in nature. Does that mean that the CFO, in your roles as the CFO of those companies, is your focus a shift more to operations?
Yes, definitely. You get involved in all kinds of decisions. And I'd like to say you have to have a microscope and a telescope at the same time. I review bank reconciliations because it's that level. On their hand, I have, you're involved in big decisions about, do you open a showroom somewhere, or do you participate with vendors in a new country.
Perhaps let's take a little bit of a digression because I've introduced the company as a CPG firm. Tell us a little bit about what you do and some of the operations so that we can learn it.
Well, current company is in home furnishings, and we manufacture and design lamps, chandeliers, and furniture. We have operations in the Philippines and China. We have a third-party agency that we buy out of India. Most of our goods are imported.
So from a finance perspective, you're dealing with some of that international inbound cost.
Yes.
But your sales market typically is here in the U.S.
I'd say 95% is now in the U.S. We sell across the country. But we anticipate in the future to we do have a small international business, and we anticipate to grow that.
Yeah, a lot of growth comes out from that. Well, that's great. And have you seen any change in terms of the information systems? Obviously, we're talking about spreadsheets, but spreadsheets perhaps are the tip of the iceberg in terms of the information. In your current role, you do manage the information technology area. Do the systems that support the small company have the same needs as the systems that you managed at the public companies? And perhaps, are there any specific benefits that small company software?
Well, it's actually a lot easier than it used to be in small companies. At one time, it was a distinct disadvantage. I remember doing an M&A job at a place where they kept all their records on an Apple IIe. Now, that dates me a little bit, but... So there used to be not the IT resources available, but over time it's really drastically changed. Like recently, we bought iPads for all our reps, and we have our catalogs on them, and eventually they'll be able to place orders right off the iPads. Now, we're able to do that fairly quickly because we're a small company. We don't have, 10,000 people to roll it out to and all the security issues and everything else. So small companies have the advantage of they can often roll out technology quicker as long as it's not bleeding edge technology. It's technology that's been proven and you can use. So, yeah, there's advantages. But again, as all small companies, you can move quicker and more nimbly than the big elephants can.
What about the actual ERP software or accounting system that runs the good old general ledger, the good old chart of accounts? Do you find any differences in terms of the softwares that you've seen? And I know that you've seen several different software accounting packages.
Yeah, it's they're getting more, with the exception maybe SAP, which is a distinct product.
And in fact, one of our sponsors.
One of your sponsors, yes. They tend to get more generic because they're all moving a lot down market. And when they're doing that, they're having to kind of make themselves more friendly to small business environment. So we're benefiting from, in general, from moving down market. And, of course, some companies love like QuickBooks. They keep all their. I'm always amazed by some of the size of the companies I've heard that are running their whole business on QuickBooks.
I've seen $100 million companies using QuickBooks very successfully.
Yeah, so yes, for small businesses, you do have some advantages.
And do you find that the software that you have now, that they are moving to your terminology down market, at the same time, not only are they kind of compressing from a vertical perspective, but from a horizontal perspective, they're growing. It's almost like it's the same volume, but in a different squeeze of space. Do you now have tie-ins to your CRM, to your sales engine?
Yeah, it's almost like too many opportunities. All of them are trying to expand their product offerings. They're trying to sell you a car with special brakes or it's just all that. Yes, CRM's a big product everybody's pushing. ERP's become fairly passe. Everybody does it. But a lot of sales oriented, the internet, web, we have a lot of, we have a web presence. So everybody's trying to get into those new areas of opportunity. And like I said, the iPad is another example of a technology that somebody else may supplant iPads. That's a technology that's going to take off one way or the other.
Yeah. Visual and touch and capability to get access. Now, would you anticipate through time that those, call it iPads in terms of a generic order entry capture, how close is that to being integrated to your general ledger? Is that within foreseeable future?
It's going to be 6 months probably that we'll do that.
That's great. And I could say 5 and 10 years ago when I went into corporations, that was a substantial effort to what is called go mobile for the sales department.
Well, that's the advantage of new technology. How many apps are there? I don't I lose track of how many apps there are, iPads and iPhones, and there's all these developers, and they're selling these apps for very reasonable prices. Mm-hmm. So it's a great opportunity for small business to even maybe take a leg up on bigger businesses that, you know, would take a huge investment for them, and it's for us, it's not all that big.
Now, also, from the perspective that you're managing those information technologies, the CFO and the finance function is overseeing the risk element. Are there any particular risks that come into those new technologies you're using?
Well, the risks are two kind. Actually, one time's regulatory, because all FTC is bringing out new regs. The banks are, it's called PCI compliance, I think, about credit card risk. The whole security issue is becoming more and more out there in a regulatory format. And also from a business standpoint, you don't want people hacking your site to get your customer list. So they're from a regulatory comment, you know, they're just demanding more and more, and it's going to get worse. There's something called the red flag that FTC is coming out with soon that I'm still trying to digest, and that's one of the parts about being a small company. I get to digest it. I don't have an IT manager to do that for me.
Well, that's very unique. And in that regard, not only are the FASB's changing pretty quickly, but so is the information technology standards. They're changing, and you've got to keep up with that. Well, how have you seen the actual role of the CFO change over time in terms of your career? Today, you lead finance and accounting, as well as the information systems we've talked about and human resources. Is the role of the CFO becoming more one of managing information technology? Obviously, in a smaller company, you've talked about managing those multiple hats. But do you see that transition?
I think it's been since I started in the business world, we've seen that. I remember the first Apple IIe's, the IBM PCs, when they first came out.
I remember implementing an IBM, I think it was a System 36 and then a System 38 with six terminals.
I had a friend of mine who started a consultancy on just doing macros for the first Lotus spreadsheets that came out. And now it's progressed over time. So gradually technology is taking over the number crunching, they're still in museums, they're still the old calculators that you used to have, the mechanical ones that crank back and forth. So yes, definitely that's been the big transition. It's become more and more automated, and it's actually freed people to become more business partners rather than just, as I said, number crunchers.
And that's a good thing.
Yes. Yeah.
All of a sudden you can start projecting rather than counting up what already happened.
Or adding columns five times.
Adding columns. Oh, my gosh, yeah. I remember as an auditor, on day one, you'd be, as the junior on the audit, you'd be given green bar printouts that would be, I don't know, 1,000 pages, and they'd say, add that up.
Or comparing tapes, yes, all those things.
Yeah.
Great fun in those days.
Great fun. Good training. Thank goodness it's behind us, right? Well, many companies, both private and public, have struggled through what many might call the Great Recession from a small company perspective. Are there any particular lessons that you have drawn from that?
Well, actually, you referred to it at the start of your talk was about cash. Really, cash isn't, it's not king, it's the whole royal family. I mean, it's everything thrown together. I noticed that highly leveraged companies were very vulnerable to even a modest turndown. They may have survived, but they had to cut back product offerings, close places, and they're now struggling for air, being cash, and they're just not going to emerge quickly from the recession. And we see that all the time, not just in my industry, but other people I talk to. That's a common problem. We don't have any money to do anything anymore. It's all tied up with the banks, and often the banks have withdrawn. Bankers are hard to find. I mean, I think they're hiding somewhere in Bahamas because you can't make appointments anymore.
Are you serious? They're just kind of persona non grata.
Well,
I'm not going to ask you who your bankers are.
But no, our bankers are fine. But I just know that talking to other people that the old joke about bankers only want to lend to you when you don't need them is really half true anyway. Yeah. Is that they're very paranoid about risk for good reason. I mean, they're really under the microscope. All banks are. And being under the microscope means they're going to react to that. And they're going to make double sure. They're asking for personal guarantees all the time nowadays from small businesses, whether they need them or not. It's just like you shall have a personal guarantee. So that's the problem.
Almost like a prenup on marriage, huh?
Yes. And they ought to. And that's actually a business opportunity. I've seen some people exploit that are now going out non-bank loan officers that are
almost like a private loan situation.
Yeah.
There actually are. You make a very valid point. There are beginning to be more and more investment. Consider the equivalent of a VC firm or a private equity firm that are considering loans rather than purchases of equity.
The second thing I was going to mention was really, particularly if you deal with just a few large accounts, is making sure your customers are profitable. A lot of companies have big revenue generators as customers that they never make any money on.
Translating the sale to cash for you, as well as helping make sure that that is a profitable buy for them.
Right. I think I talked to a turnaround specialist over dinner, and he says one of the first things he does is when his businesses fire the 20% of his customers, he puts it, because they're just not profitable. And a lot of them are big box stores that they, you know, they're a lot of revenue, but at the end of the day, you're just not making any money on these people. It's time to, turn that business away and concentrate on profitable accounts and adjust yourself to the business level that's profitable.
So in your role, are you how much are you meeting with customers and vendors and bankers and such?
Well, I deal with bankers on a regular business. Customers, we have trade shows we go to. We have trade showrooms in Atlanta, in Dallas, and High Point. So I do meet customers a little bit there. Also our reps. We're business to business. We don't sell retail. And our reps are our primary drivers of our business. And I meet with them at every show that I attend.
And are they feeling the pinch?
Because we're doing fairly well, our reps are doing very well. And they're real happy with us right now. So we're, and our business has been doing, recover nicely as the economy's recovered.
Now, what do you think as you look out, the recent stats that came out from the Department of Labor talked about some states that have increased, some states that are stagnant, and there really isn't a whole lot of upward movement and shift. What do you see in terms of that economic outlook from your position? I know that you're part of some local groups that are financial executives. What are you hearing, if you will, on the street?
Well, it does vary by state. States around Texas, Oklahoma seem to be doing fairly well. Michigan, you know, the upper Midwest is really having problems. And we see that in our business and at our company. There's some parts of the country that are doing fairly well. Other parts, Southern California, you talk to people in any group, California's problematic. Same thing with upper Midwest, Michigan, not so much Wisconsin, but Michigan and Ohio and Indiana. The old industrial states are still having a lot of problems. And to some extent, also in the Northeast, which were hit by the financial problems of Goldman Sachs and everybody else up there, Lehman Brothers, they're still struggling in some areas, particularly like upstate New York is a problem.
One of the things that I have noticed regionally is the uptick in terms of employment. Are you seeing that? I know that you chair some career and development organizations locally. Are you seeing movement? Are people now getting jobs?
Yeah, it's a very big dichotomy. You see people are getting jobs, but you still see a lot of people that are long-term unemployed. So you see a lot of people that are kind of new, and then a lot of people that are long-term unemployed and not a lot in the middle. So, yes, you are seeing some people getting jobs, but a lot of people are still struggling trying to find new careers because in Atlanta, the example, construction business. If you were in the residential construction business, good luck trying to find a job. I mean, it's tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And real estate is a very key
commercial
indicator. Yeah, that's a very key indicator, and I think the time will tell. Hopefully, commercial property and residential property prices will increase, hopefully labor will increase at the same time. Certainly, and the beauty of economic downturn, if you track through history, we've seen that it is the small business and the entrepreneur that is hiring, and that is what fuels the growth of the economy. So kudos to you for making the move from the public to the series of companies that are going to be the foundation and the backbone of the country's improvement. Well, Mike, I must say it's a little bit of a shame. We've come to the end of the show, but we have a tradition on the show. One more question, and we like to ask you your CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
Well, mine is that if you have a 401k plan at your company and you've not bid out that work since 2007, you ought to think about doing that. Since 2007, the fees that 401k providers charge have come down a lot. Also, actually, it's good for you to do that from your own fiduciary responsibility. If you've ever audited by the Department of Labor, you're kind of expected to go out and bid your work now and then. We bid ours out last summer, and we reduced our fees like 40%. So there's some big – if you haven't done it since 2007, it's probably time to go out. And even if it's just your current provider cuts his rates.
That is a great tip. We love hearing cash-saving tips and profit-saving tips all in one. Well, Mike, thank you very much to Mike Moran, our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. Thank you also to our contributors. And we would like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information, please go to www.delaneyllc.com. Thanks also go to SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solutions for small to medium-sized companies. For more information on them, go to www.sap.com/SME. And last but not least, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website is www.financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show or know of someone who would be, please contact us via the web. And thank you for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.